thank you very much for having me. And I suspect that this is probably going to be the most knowledgeable audience I have yet addressed on this subject. I'm looking forward very much to the question and answer session, and probably I'll be asking you more questions than you might expect. And to stress that I'm really not an Iraqi expert. I'm an expert on what I did for the Venice Biennale, but come to you with some humility, I must say, because it's something that was done very quickly, and it's an area in which very little work has been done. That is to say, the area of contemporary art, because virtually in Iraq now there's no infrastructure for contemporary art. There are very few museums. In fact, there is a sort of a remnant of a museum of art in Baghdad. There is nothing like the Serpentine Gallery in Iraq. And there's nobody when you arrive in Iraq, you can phone. You can't phone a go-to guy in Basra and say, you know, what's happening with video installation, you know, these days, please, you know, tell me what's a hot topic in performance art in Kurdistan, because there just is not that kind of expertise, and there is not that kind of communication that's occurring, the kind of communication that we enjoy in our part of the world in a relatively peaceful Western world. And so one is dealing with raw material, very, very raw, and communication is more or less artist. It's what you hear on a grapevine rather than what you can read in a periodical or gain from some website dedicated to contemporary art in that area. So that's the kind of landscape that I was starting to navigate. I was invited not because I was an Iraqi art expert, but because I had worked, as was mentioned before, on a number of exhibitions, international exhibitions, one of which was in Sharjah in 2007, the Sharjah Biennial. Also, I'd been a curator for a Palestinian biennial 2009-2010. And I guess that the foundation, the commissioning foundation for the pavilion, the Iraqi pavilion in Venice, felt that I was conversant with art in that part of the world and probably could look after myself to some extent. You have to be, what's the word? You can't insist on five-star hotels in Iraq and, you know, the right thread count in your bed linen. I mean, you have to roll your sleeves up and do a lot yourself, which I'm happy to do. Now, the commissioning foundation is the Ruya Foundation, and I know that not that long ago you were addressed by Tamara Shalaby, and she is an expert in many things. Among them is Gertrude Bell, and that's why she was here. But with me, she was very much a partner in crime. Partner, she was very much my partner in terms of the production of this exhibition, and it was a huge support, both moral and practical, of the Ria Foundation that made it possible. a national pavilion in Venice is ostensibly a showcase for a national culture, what is happening right now in this particular art world, and this art world, the one that I was asked to look at, was Iraq. Until then, in Venice, the previous pavilion, for example, had involved artists who were Iraqi, but they were working outside of the country. They were working in Helsinki, they were working in Berlin, in London, in New York, and I felt strongly that it would be interesting to look at those who were there, living and working inside Iraq. It was thought to be very difficult. I was told by many people that I wouldn't find anything there, that all the good ones had gone, and that there had been such a brain drain that I'd be dealing with the sort of dregs of an art world. And of course, as soon as somebody tells you that that's the deal, then you know you feel even more So I felt, and I suspected strongly, given the experience that I had, that I would find something there. It's just that you're not going to find it in an obvious place. You're not going to find a commercial gallery with a list, and you can then pick from that list like you would a dish from a menu. It was a question, very much as I was saying, of going down little alleyways, little byways, and finding things that may not even resemble fine art. I knew that I had this venue. This is the Palazzo Dandolo, which is on the Grand Canal. It is beautiful. Beautiful place originally for the Dandolo family, but more recently they let apartments here for tourists. And a very smart smart move on the part of the Rio Foundation and Tamara's part particularly was to choose an apartment, to rent an apartment and make that the pavilion for Iraq. It is a very luxurious place, and Venice could probably be thought of as the polar opposite of Baghdad in terms of luxury and in terms of comfort. Venice is, it must be amongst the top five, and millions of tourists go there every year, and the opposite is the case, as you know, in Baghdad and in other Iraqi cities. In order to make this point very clear, I want to show you the next slide, which is the Museum of War Crimes in Sulaymaniyah. This was the headquarters for Saddam Hussein and his intelligence services, which is a euphemism really for torture and execution. Horrible crimes were committed in this place, and it was liberated as Kurdistan was liberated in 1991, and the bloody bitter battle that occurred around this building is conveyed by the pockmarked facade of this building. It's now a museum. It's a museum of the torture that was undertaken by Saddam. But at the same time, it's very incongruous in there, because then you also see certain rooms and galleries that are dedicated to the promotion of Iraqi culture, particularly craft work. But there is, on the other hand, this incongruity that I was talking about between Venice and Iraq. The idea of calling this exhibition Welcome to Iraq was to some extent a defiance of expectation. I didn't want people to come to see an exhibition that was in some ways a replication of the awfulness that you saw on Newsnight and other current affairs programs. I was sure that I would find people who were as concerned with the things that have to get done in everyday life as much as they were with the politics and the very difficult political situation that they were facing, and the terrorism and the bombings that were occurring. But I wanted to emphasize that at the same time children are going to school in Iraq. People go to the markets and they go shopping. People have, they fall in love, and there are families, and all kinds of other everyday things are happening that are woven through the fabric of everyday life in this place. The same is true in Palestine. That's an art world that I'm much more familiar with. And I'm interested to meet artists who live and work in Ramallah, for example, who say, I'm not going to give you the checkpoint art you want in the West. Yes, we acknowledge that this is a problem and a really significant fact of our lives, but at the same time, there are other things that we may want to do. We may want to paint abstract paintings, and just because we live in Palestine, why shouldn't we do that? And what I've found is that very often the artists who are living and working in these places that feature on the television news are the ones who aren't actually dealing with those topics. It's the ones, the artists who are in exile, who tend to be more interested in geopolitics and much more explicit as far as those issues are concerned. So this was an exhibition which, whilst acknowledging all of that, was concerned with other aspects of everyday life. And in so doing, I was sort of playing with what I knew would be expectation, a kind of popular imagination. The other thing to say as well, the title and the nature of the exhibition too, conveyed the hospitality that I enjoyed in Iraq, in spite of the awful circumstances. It's extraordinary what lengths people go to make you feel welcome. How often I was invited into somebody's home, because that's where the studios were. If there was a gallery, it was usually in somebody's basement underneath domestic residence. And you know, the effort that was made to welcome me and welcome those that I was traveling with is, well, it epitomized everything that we hear about Arabic hospitality. And I wanted to place emphasis on that. In spite of the difficulty, it still survived. This is the Grand Canal, the venue that we had is just around that corner. This is Basra. This is Shatt al-Arab. This is where the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates. This is the symbol of the dysfunction that characterizes everyday life in Iraq. This, not only the sunken ship that you see in the foreground, but in the background, this desert is the deforested landscape as a result of the Iran-Iraq war. This would have been a landscape full of millions and millions of palm trees that were removed by Saddam Hussein in the waging of the war with Iran. Iran is that way. And there's no place for anyone to hide in this landscape. And the awful legacy in terms of the environment is something that is very hard. You can't fail to notice it, and it's something of a preoccupation with a number of the artists that I was working with. And speaking of the environment, the whole question of ecology, the kind of things that we take for granted here, the sorting of our rubbish into plastics and cardboards and to metals and whatnot. I mean, that from an Iraqi point of view now seems like such a luxury. This is the work of Abdul Rahim Yassir, a cartoonist in Baghdad. And he was an incredibly useful artist from my point of view. Without having to write anything down to have some explanatory panel in my exhibition, I had this cartoonist whose work, each work was worth at least 1,000 words, how eloquently and with such humor he could convey what it was like being in Baghdad as a resident, the kind of experience that you have as you're walking down a road here, a road which is full of rubbish to the extent that it becomes almost a monument and equal in height to the historic buildings that you see there in the background. This is the traffic jam. If you've been in Baghdad recently, you will probably have been stuck in traffic for hours and hours and hours as you're waiting for that roadblock to be removed or in a diversion because that bridge is no longer a bridge you can drive across. Some politician insists on getting to the airport without any other cars on the road, so everybody else has to take another way. And here, you know, the point that he's making is, well, you know, I throw my watch out of the window. There's no point trying to be punctual because there's a lot of cars. I mean, this is, of course, this is a country that floats on fossil fuel, and you know, there's no public transport, and there are lots and lots too many cars. There is an electricity grid that also doesn't work. Again, if you know, if you've been to Baghdad recently, to many cities in that part of the world, I mean, people talking about Gaza often in the same way. How often the electricity stops and you're plunged into pitch darkness, and then you start to hear the generator start up, and then lights flicker on again, and you've got that kind of power for an hour or so, and then the grid comes back on stream, and then the generators, you hear them, the sound of the generators dying away. It's disconcerting when you go to Iraq for the first time, and you're having dinner with people, and then all of a sudden, you can't see anything, and everybody else talks as if it's kind of normal, and you feel you're not quite sure what's going on. After a while, you get used to it. Like all those guns, it's just the first day or so. It's quite disconcerting. This is Abdul Rahim. You see his image of the man trying to find his light bulb using a torch. Very smart. The sense of humor in his work, and how clever he is with respect to the medium of drawing. The idea, he plays around with the idea of representation cleverly. Representation not only of the cartoon, but also the medium of television. Here, imagine, you know, we're watching Newsnight, and that hardly ever happens. But he uses, you know, such wit to bring home the fact that, you know, what is worlds away for us is a very present threat for people living there. So this is that, and then there's a business of security. Here's the man being frisked, hands up in a gesture of surrender, but of course he still has his gun. And if you ever had any doubt about the profits to be derived from the arms industry, Iraq, you know, very quickly clears it up for you. Everybody's got a gun, and the amount of machine guns is, again, it's a bit like the plunging into darkness because of the failure of the electric grid. That's disconcerting, and so too are the guns, you know, that you see at every turn. The other thing that is often talked about in Iraq now as much as ever is the corruption of politicians. The fact that they're so disconnected from their electorate and they don't deal with them. I mean, here he's talking, this politician talking to the people that might vote for him, but in the way are these blast walls again, an omnipresence of these structures. They're like the Berlin Wall, even higher, like the wall that snakes through between Israel and Palestine. How every road, you know, major road in Baghdad seems to be lined by these walls. When I stayed in Baghdad, I was living in a house in Mansour that was behind these walls. You become so familiar, this confrontation with the blank grey surface of the blast wall, as does this artist, who is Abdul Rahim Yassir, and so many of the people that I met. This is what, I mean, you dream of a tree, but all you see are these serried ranks of blast walls. This is a very poignant image, and you'll see why later on in the lecture. The sequence of slides, there's a correspondence between images that I'm going to show you later in this image. And then finally, I want to show you this picture by him. This is, again, an image of the artist painting the bomb, almost fixated by the subject in an auto-destructive way, like Narcissus. You become so, I mean, he's staying there painting this thing that eventually is going, well, eventually quite quickly is going to be his destruction. So that is what Iraq is like through the eyes of an artist. A cartoonist doesn't refer to himself as an artist. I'm not particularly hung up on that myself. So this was the kind of, you know, very quickly when you're in Iraq, you start to see it the same way. This is what it's like in Venice. On the other hand, this is the interior of Palazzo Dandolo, and this is the raw material that I had to deal with as a curator. And it was suggested to me that we can clear out these rooms. This is a drawing room next to the main reception area. You see at the top here the piano nobile and the windows at the end on the of the image at the top there. These are the windows that are actually looking onto the Grand Canal. And I was told, well, you know, we can get rid of all this furniture and we can make it look more like an art gallery. But I felt that it would be interesting to not do that. Instead, it was a very seductive interior. It's very hard to, I could do nothing to this space and people would have loved my pavilion. And given what I was telling you before, which was very much the attitude with which I arrived to this project, I wanted to make a very comfortable exhibition. I wanted to make an exhibition where people would stay, that they'd hang around in this place, they'd sit there, they'd sort of meet their friends. I wanted to create a social space. I didn't want to create an exhibition. I didn't want to pretend that we were in a museum, like a modern museum. I didn't want a white cube, as they say. Here, this room at the bottom, this is the kitchen. And it's a very nice place. And there is a table around which many people can sit. So we decided to sort of capitalize on what it had to offer, not to pretend that we weren't here at all. We were in Venice. And I wanted this to be a place that people would be naturally drawn to think about what everyday life was like in Iraq. So rather than removing the chandeliers and taking all the furniture away, what we did, the strategy was, in fact, to replace those works of art that you've seen previously on the walls of this reception room, for example, where there had been maritime paintings. I used work by this artist, Kazim Nawir, who's living in Ilah, near Babylon. Instead of the carpets and rugs that we had on the floor previously, we replaced them with these rugs that we bought in Erbil. And similarly, other Kurdish fabrics were thrown over the sofas. On the table, instead of guidebooks to Venice, we had books about Iraq. So you see this circular table here. In the foreground, piled with books that were by Iraqi writers. There were a number of editions of Gilgamesh. There were a number of Agatha Christie novels. There were books on cooking. There were children's books. It was a vast library that we collected, with the help, actually, of librarians in Baghdad, too, and eBay. The opportunity that this exhibition afforded, you just sit there for days and days if you wanted to and read on this subject. The laptop on the table, well, it's the kind of thing that people have in their apartments, but instead of it being useful to go online and start searching for something, we actually had films playing on these laptops, looping. We had two or three of them in the apartment, and you could sit down on the chair, put headphones on, and watch some short films that were being made by a group of filmmakers in Baghdad. Seems appropriate, in fact, that this would be the case, because people don't go to the cinema very much in Iraq. And films are watched on phones, they're watched on computers, laptops, is the way this culture is being consumed. And you could sit and watch these little soap opera episodes that had been made by usually quite young, often male filmmakers. Here is the drawing room that you saw first of all. This is the paintings of the marshlands here above the sofa. More books, some ornaments, little sculptures that I'll talk about later as well, decorating bookshelves and various cabinets. The carpet here is again from Erbil. In the kitchen, we had a bakery not far from Venice in Fusina. Anyway, it was at Amestra. We had a bakery that was making kletcher. And we had this man, he's Lebanese, not Iraqi, but we had an Iraqi woman go to Venice and teach him how to make these wonderful biscuits and how to make Iraqi tea in a traditional way. And every day, we had it for the opening, but throughout the entire exhibition for 3 or 4 months, if you went to this pavilion, you would be treated to these free biscuits and teas. And not only was I providing you with nice, comfortable furniture, you could also get refreshed. You could take this out into the sitting room if you wanted. You'd read a book, watch a film, talk to friends, and thereby communicate this idea of hospitality that I was referring to before. We also had music. This went on continuously through the show. It was the heart of the exhibition in many ways. We had music at the opening. It was very expensive and frankly impractical to have people playing in your pavilion all day long, every day for 4 or 5 months. They wear their fingers out at the very least. So what we had instead were recordings of the music that these two played. I'll tell you their names. They're both from Baghdad. They are Ali Hassan and Dured Fadil. And we had CDs of their music, and we had them played on this little radio. We had implanted into this cardboard sculpture of a radio the music that they actually played for us on the opening day. In fact, I was referring to the catalogue just now. This is quite an important part of the exhibition. If you leaf through the catalogue, there's a wonderful essay by Tamara Shalaby, my account of the artwork you can see, but there's more useful there. For example, there is a discography. You can see what was being played on the radio by these two musicians. There's a list of the pieces. There is a list of all the books. Our bibliography for this catalogue was a list of all the books that were there to be read in the pavilion. And most interesting for some people are the recipes that we have for the biscuits and for the tea. They're in here as well. So it's a kind of, it's like a manual to the aspects of everyday Iraqi life that we were dealing with. The work by these two artists, Yasin Wami and Hashim Tai from Basra, it was a highlight. That radio is just a tip of the iceberg. The bedroom towards the back of the apartment was for them actually stripped out, and they replaced the furniture with their cardboard sculptures of a bed, of a bookcase, of a sofa, books. They made so much actually in the apartment itself in situ. There are sculptures, the clock, the washstand, the jug, etc. It was a kind of recycling depot. And this is interesting, given this idea of ecology that I was referring to earlier. They are very interested in taking rubbish and turning it into something of value. And so as artwork was being unpacked in one room, they'd be sort of moving around looking to see what cardboard boxes might be available for them for their work, what sort of padded paper and bubble wrap might be used as well. So a lot of this work was made. A lot of it was made in Basra and brought to Venice, but a lot was actually made in this place, and it was sort of wonderful. Through the installation of the show, we had these two artists. All the artists went, by the way. Every artist that was in the show was in Venice for the Biennale to represent their own work, but also to have a chance to see what artists from all over the world were doing right now. I mean, that in itself was a very important aspect of our project. Here is the Rose Gallery, which Hashim referred to, so he said it was like family portraits. And again, the sort of wit that he brings to bear on this work is really something. The sculpture that you see, well, it's a sculpture of a sculpture. I mean, what's clever about this is the representation of the beds, of the furniture, of the books, but then there's a representation of artwork itself. So you have a sculpture of paintings and a sculpture of a sculpture here, a kind of primitivist sculpture that you see in the foreground. And a really interesting, significant touch was this little white plinth that he put under the sculpture. He said, you know, I need a plinth. And I'm not really a plinth kind of guy. You know, contemporary sculpture doesn't need plinths. But he was so insistent that he had a plinth for this. And then it dawns on you that he's been so smart about the institution of art, the way it's framed, how it's signified. And, you know, this is a sculpture of a sculpture, and a sculpture has a plinth. And so we have this polyurethane square, again, that's part of the packing for something else. It's cut up and then put on the floor, and the sculptor put on that. I wrote in the catalogue about the ecological nature of their work being symbolic of something much more, about the possibility of a sort of resurrection, of a cultural resurrection, if you like. And it was really interesting to hear them arrive in Venice and say the same thing. I mean, that they got exactly that. The idea that something could be thought of as worthless could be deemed valuable if you just cared for it, took some imagination to it. I mean, rubbish, litter, is a huge problem in Iraq. This is something to put in parentheses, but if you're driving down a road, you know, driving to Babylon from Baghdad, for example, the amount of rubbish there, which signifies this kind of idea that it's not worth caring, and this place isn't worth caring for. So many plastic bags, so much scrap paper, so much rubbish that's just strewn over the landscape. What was a very beautiful landscape of Iraq. This man, Akil Karif, again in Baghdad, he probably doesn't think of himself as an artist, more of a workshopping artist with a strong emphasis on ecology, and he's often taking things that are thrown away and then turning them into something useful. And he has some work, interestingly, on when I was there on exhibition in the reception area of the Ministry of Culture in Baghdad. Here, out of the tubular frames for generators, for petrol generators to create the power when the grid shuts off, what he's done, I mean, the generator's gone, but you've got the framework, and he's taken two of these, one on top of the other, welded them together to create an armchair, and he then wove this fabric to create a back and a seat of the chair. Here is the product of bits of bicycles. You'll see the wheel arches, the forks, and the cogs for the chains of the bicycle that form the legs and feet of the chair, and the seat itself is made from woven bicycle tires. Again, an artist who is absolutely concerned with making good and getting by, as we often hear ourselves saying in the contemporary art world, an idea of not working with traditional artistic materials, not working with oil on canvas, cast bronze, etc. You know, what is there to hand and how can we be creative with it? And by doing so, symbolizing the possibility, something quite hopeful, optimistic about what the future might hold. Iraq has been through so many years, decade upon decade of, you know, one wave of awfulness breaking over another. And you know, it's impossible not to be. I mean, you arrive in Iraq with the knowledge of such a thing, the Iran-Iraq war, the sanctions, the invasion, and the awful aftermath of the invasion. And Watanabe Street was such a casualty in 2007. And there is this extraordinary reconstruction of Watanabe Street. And again, it's a hopeful sign. Something good could come out of the chaos, the carnage that was wreaked on this place. There's a little cafe that end of the street. There are portraits of these young men behind the bar. And the guy, the proprietor of the cafe, he's still there. But these are all his sons who were killed in that bombing in 2007. It's very symbolic that this street should be reconstructed when you think of the very bookish nature of Iraqi culture and the pride that that is taken in the reconstruction, the resurrection of this place. And it was wonderful. It meant a lot to me to be there. It was a great privilege to see this happening as it had been happening, you know, for such a long time. The break that was made through that terrorist act, and then this positive impulse to remake, to make good and to get by. Not that far from Watanabe Street is Muslim Saria, very ancient school in Baghdad. This is what we found there. It's closed to the public, but we were given access to it. We had such good help from people there, such generosity and goodwill. This is a place that hasn't been really put back together again, certainly not accessible, not put back together in a way that makes it accessible to the public. We wandered around the rooms and by chance came across this sacks full of old photographs and archival documents relating to the Museum of Antiquities. One is sort of reminded of the care of the archivist, the careful work the curators do, how everything is put into order, everything is documented, and yet what chaos, is the experience that takes place. The looting of the museums that you know about, and the what was functional, what worked, what was signifying sophisticated culture was treated like rubbish. This is something that that occurs to a woman artist, one of two women artists that we showed. This is Furat Al-Jamil, who is based in Baghdad. And she uses the broken Mesopotamian pot as a symbol for a broken culture. But again, the hopeful symbol of the honeycomb, which is suspended above. This is not in Venice, by the way. This is an image that she gave us for the catalogue. And significant that she chose this setting, I think, for her sculpture, because of its emphasis on nature and the idea that perhaps a man-made solution to the problem of Baghdad is not maybe it's not the most efficacious. Perhaps if we're going to find solutions elsewhere, gentler and in nature. And it was with this kind of thought that we went to the marshlands again, like Watanabe Street. had been wrecked, not through, well, it's a kind of terrorism, but through the extraordinary cultural genocide that was visited on these people by Saddam Hussein. They were not, he thought of them as political, they were political opponents, and the revenge was basically to turn the taps off, metaphorically speaking. The water was diverted, dams were built, dikes, and what was the home for thousands and thousands of water buffalo and 70,000 marsh Arabs became a desert, and that the populations of people and animals dwindled. And then since the deposition of Saddam Hussein, the waters come back, not to the same extent, but still, you get a strong idea of the way that life was lived in a more sustainable way, kind of way that Farhat al-Jamia would advocate. These are people who, more or less, they're not so keen on profits of profits and unsustainable growth. They, we talked to these people and they were so sort of happy with what they were doing and the way they fitted in with their environment. And I realize I'm sounding very sentimental and romantic, but this was one of the most special days of my life, going to the marshlands. How funny they were. This woman particularly, she was so funny about her husband and his girlfriend. Here she is, cutting reeds, and talking about, she was saying, what more do I need? She's got friends, and she's busy, and she lives in a house like this, continually making things with the reeds, the houses, the baskets, all kinds of things made from this basic material, and then away from the water here, on the land, by the side of the marshes, people weaving carpets, material that would be used for walls and roofs as well. Here you've got close-up detail of the weaving that you saw in the previous slide. It occurred to us how deep in the psyche the culture of the marsh Arabs was, not just for those who actually lived there, but throughout the country. In fact, how far back people go in their minds. The artists that we met thinking of themselves as being in a tradition that leapfrogged over Islamic culture, way back to Mesopotamian and Sumerian culture. It was constantly in the conversation. The marshlands and the rehabilitations of the rehabilitation of the marshlands mean so much. Here, back in Baghdad, on the glass walls, here is a landscape of the marshlands. This is the product of one of those artists, as you saw in Abdul Rahim's cartoon, standing in front of this place, but imagining somewhere else, imagining a beautiful place. I mean, this is a wonder of the world. This is the Garden of Eden, some people think. And you when you're there, you can see why. For this reason, I was very keen to show the work of Bassim al-Shakir. He is a young artist in Baghdad, now actually in America, on the verge of getting his green card. He's actually the youngest artist in the show, but probably making the most conservative work. But I thought it was interesting that he should have such an academic style, a conservative style, if you like, when dealing with tradition. His family comes from this place, and he would go there, and in a kind of yearning, like the man painting the palm tree in front of the blast walls, a kind of yearning for a lifestyle that he doesn't enjoy. So we had these paintings hanging above the sofas in the drawing room. This is the other tragedy. This is Babylon. And this is how Babylon was about Babylon looked like this 100 years ago, now looks more like that, thanks to Saddam Hussein. The idea that this was a World Heritage Site and that it's been written off the list now because of this building that has occurred, building on the ruins with the sensitivity of sort of out-of-town supermarket. It's an extraordinary gesture that he made. And, I mean, he made it with bricks stamped with his name on it. Not Nebuchadnezzar, but the Saddam Hussein, the new Nebuchadnezzar. He built a palace on a hill. And you look down on his Babylon. We went here. We went inside. And again, it's a place that you're not often having access to. Here we are in his reception room. This is these are the soldiers that I was traveling with. I must stress, I was looked after so well. We traveled in bulletproof cars, and there were always people around making sure that we were safe. This was the, it's hard to see here, so much clearer on my screen, that this is a platform, and on this platform is a kind of throne, and Saddam Hussein would sit on this throne and receive visitors. Yes, if you could do that, that would be great, actually. Is that better? Yes, anyway, here they are again, and here is the barbed wire that is in front of the staircase that takes you up to the bedrooms. All the fine furniture and all the luxury has been stripped away, and you've got a kind of shell of Saddam Hussein's palace. I mean, it was extraordinary being there, thinking about what it must have been like when he was alive. Then, after he went, the Americans moved in, and they used it as a kind of dormitory. And they also use it as a basketball court. And you can see the basketball ring there. And then the Americans leave. And then there's another layer. People move in down with the USA. I mean, some of the graffiti is very political. Some of it is, well, I mean, it's very right with what you see anywhere. And there's a heart. And it's, you know, people do fall in love still in Iraq. And they're going to be together forever, as signified by this heart. People leave their phone numbers, tell you that they were here. You've got this sort of fascinating graffiti that says so much, but it's another form of cultural expression, and it's an inspiration to the artist that I was showing you before. This is Kazim Nawiya, the artist from Hila, which is near Babylon, so close to this place. Unlike Basim, who was making paintings of palm trees and the marshlands, this guy is much more interested in a more urban experience. The sort of layering of colours, like the layering of graffiti on walls and streets, the use of these kind of crude drawings, appealing, they're like children's drawings, but also the kind of rough symbolic drawings you find in graffiti. You see people, wheels, trees, numbers that have been stenciled on 2003, which is the year of Saddam's deposition. Some trees running down here. Things that aren't quite so clear. Kind of, it's a bit like using codes that you might find in graffiti on a wall. You don't know what they mean, but you know that they mean something, something quite personal. And I must say, this is very sophisticated, painting. In Sulaymaniyah, there was this piece of graffiti that I noticed. This is at the pop end of the spectrum when it comes to graffiti. It's around the corner from a studio by the studio of an artist I'm going to show you next. I was walking across the road and I noticed this, and normally you wouldn't maybe think so much of it. I mean, it's some designer group, you can see that is responsible for it. And this is Sulaymaniyah. This is sort of far, far away from Babylon and Baghdad. But again, you know, it's decorative. So you maybe not take it quite so seriously. But then on the other hand, the message is quite profound, depending on where you place your emphasis on the words. Life is very nice, and you know, one is only too aware of mortality in Iraq. So this is the work by the artist whose studio is just around the corner from this wall. Her name is Chiman Ismail. She is a painter, normally oil on canvas, and this is the painting by her that we showed in Venice. Poppies in a field, and I was interested in this, well, for the same reason that I was interested in the graffiti that we just saw. It's very decorative, it's beautiful. Flowers in a field, and of course they strike us here as having just been through the Tower of London poppies thing. They must be symbols of life, that pure beauty that comes out of the soil on which the blood has been spilled. Well, that's very much our symbolism, and didn't mean anything like that to Chiman. But on the other hand, this was a very important work for her, because it's actually the last painting that her husband saw before he died. And I didn't realize that when I chose it, but she then explained that that was the case, and very, very generously let us include it in our exhibition. He didn't die of, he wasn't bombed or shot. He died of a stroke. He was a filmmaker, and she loved him very much. People do fall in love in Iraq. And after he died, she has a child, and their house in Sulaymaniyah has so many reminders of him and her feelings for him. And rather than choosing more paintings by her, because she has stacks and stacks of paintings, and she shows in Spain particularly, that's one of the best known artists now and painters living in Iraq. But it was this that interested me by her. It was the way she painted on everything. It was almost as if she'd run out of canvas. Her artistic activity would then move on to the TV set and other bits of furniture. This is a TV set. I don't mean Arabic, but I understand that this is almost like the credits from a film. And it's been frozen on the screen, and it's a film by him. And then you'll see flowers that have been painted on the side, but they go around the top and the bottom and behind as well. The whole thing is covered with this, through this decorative impulse that she has, that she brings to bear on these objects. Here is a lunchbox. And it's like a cartoon, like a storyboard for a film. And her husband is the one with the moustache on the right-hand side, his brother on the left, and it tells the story of the imprisonment of the brother. And they took lunch to him in this lunchbox while he was imprisoned. I don't know why he was imprisoned. It would have been political, I'm almost sure, and not just. Here is the clock. These are things that are just there in the house. It's on the wall, it's on the cupboards. It was extraordinary to see this, and given the proposition of my exhibition, it was irresistible. And she was, it was really great that she went along with my choice of these objects rather than the paintings. This is the time when her husband died. Here is the kerosene heater. It's been covered with lots and lots of hearts, and on the top of the kerosene heater, you see these two hands using the grill for the ventilation, these two hands in which the fingers intertwine. This is Kurdistan. This is where we got so many of our fabrics for the decoration, for the rugs, and for the throws on the furniture in the apartment. And you can see, we made pillows from the fabrics. We asked for, just cloth and this cloth. Can we make a pillow from this cloth? And then we'd come back the next day, and they would have the pillows. has made for us. Here is the man in the market saying it's extraordinary. Rug. How coveted these rugs were. Actually, how many people were, they loved the pavilion. Is there any way I can buy that rug? Was something I heard often. There, here are the markets in Sulaimaniyah. Actually, in Erbil. Sorry, this is Erbil. Sorry. And it's Erbil again. And this is going to take me to the last artist I want to talk to you about. A young artist. His name is Jamal Penjweni. His story is extraordinary. Again, it's the kind of story that doesn't, you know, you're not going to find it at St. Martin's or Chelsea School of Art or Goldsmiths. He's self-taught. He was very poor, living with his mother. He remembers as a child playing in school and the bombings and the violence around that sort of, you know, the final fling, you know, towards liberation in 1991. And in such poverty, his mother and he would go to the markets and they'd sell flowers that they collected on the hillsides. They live in the northeast corner, close to the Iranian border. And then they made enough money through selling the flowers that they had in order to buy sheep. And then he became a shepherd, or what he calls himself as a sheeper. And then there's a flock of sheep, and then he starts to make sculpture, and he does become engaged somehow with an art world in Sulaimaniyah, and I'm not quite sure of the details. And he learns not only sculpture but also photography, and then becomes a war photographer, like so many young men. You know, guns and cameras almost sort of one slides into the other in terms of the way you sort of see it, and you know you're in a battlefield and you're there with a camera rather than a gun. And then he gave that up to become an artist in a way more that we would understand, and has shown, and he's only in his early 30s, has shown a little bit in group exhibitions in London through the Gulen Foundation, which is concerned with the promotion of Kurdish culture. I mean, he's featured in their programs at least once or twice. At Icon Gallery, where I'm now the director, we gave him a solo exhibition out of the experience that I had in Iraq. But this was a series that we showed in Venice. It's called Saddam Is Here. And so, of course, by the time he took these photographs, Saddam was long gone. But the point that he wanted to make was that he may be gone, but there's a certain mentality that goes with such despotism that remains and only fades through the passing of generation on generation. And to make that point, he asked people, volunteers in the street, going about their business, their everyday life, if they would hold an image of Saddam Hussein to obscure their face. And well, so much one could say about this. It was, you know, so much that one could say about the representation of a human figure in Iraq right now. It was great in Venice, which is a city of masks. And great for the point that he was trying to get across. So here you see the shepherds with Saddam Hussein. Here you see the butcher. This is particularly tough as an image. There are 12 altogether. This is just a selection. Here is a soldier who is, you know, the idea of the mask corresponds nicely to the idea of camouflage against the wall, and the foliage stylized in the camouflage corresponds to the green plant on the left-hand side. Very, very smart image. He's so sophisticated, this guy. He's one of those young artists that you meet who seem to arrive fully formed. And the way he crops his photographs, the way he edits his films, it's sort of hard to believe that he could have just done it without the benefit of several years of school. Here are the businessmen in a hotel room, all with the faces that I haven't seen. And then finally, the working girl, the glamour model, the prostitute in Silomania, who also joined in with this project. Now this is, to some extent, the end of the story of Venice, but of course, you know, a lot has happened since then. In fact, we are now in 2015, and in 2 months' time, there will be another Venice Biennale, and there will be another Iraqi pavilion, and I don't know so much about it, but in between these two biennales, there has been an extraordinary rise of ISIS. This is the most recent photograph that I have received from Jamal. He and I are in touch a lot. And how strongly this is juxtaposed with the image that you saw before. He calls it ISIS Halloween. And he talks about it like this, and this is where I'm going to finish. So, and I'll translate it slightly for you. Hello, my dear Jonathan. The Islamic fundamental people threaten me for this photo. A human dies only once in our life. The Islamic animal is in ISIS century. ISIS Halloween is part of this project. In this project, I worked for humanity, not against any religion. As people have already seen in my work, I have a message for humanity against war. ISIS Halloween shows the pain and suffering of women under the ISIS flag. We all know that there are thousands of women being killed, raped and sold and humiliated. At the same time, thousands and thousands of people got killed. Children, women, men, old and young got hurt. I see people make themselves blind about what's happening under the ISIS flag. I don't see any bad comment for them when they see what's happening in the world. I did this project to show pain and suffering that women go through, and all the people who have become homeless and their honor being taken away from them by ISIS. But in the Middle East, they look at my work as something against religion, not as art or humanity. I want to tell the world that in the Middle East, humanity comes last. First is religion, then men, and then, after all, humanity. I see the spilling of blood of innocent people gives pleasure to some people, which is very sad for society like us. I want to tell everyone that I am here to serve humanity without care about race or anything. Because of this project, ISIS Halloween, I've got lots of threats and bad comments. They may think that they can scare me or let me down about my work. I will raise my voice and say, a human dies once in our life. I'd rather die serving humanity and my community and show the world what we are going through. Best wishes, Benjamin. This is a wall in Venice. When we had the exhibition, Welcome to Iraq, there was a lot of press and a lot of conversation around it. It got a good reception. But many people, of course, would say, why aren't you showing the awfulness? I mean, you know, I come to your exhibition and it's almost as if the awfulness isn't happening in Iraq. I was assuming that people already knew that. And it was the other side of the story that I was particularly concerned to communicate. The posters that cropped up on the walls, in Dossadora particularly, on the way to the venue, with these ones, to welcome to occupied Iraq. At the time of the exhibition, ostensibly, Iraq wasn't occupied, but in the minds of some, it is. And you could say that Saddam is still here, that the Americans are still there, and that the British are still there. Well, it's extraordinary that this poster is still there. I was in Venice 2 weeks ago. I'm making an exhibition with an artist from Angola for the next Biennale, and I was on a sentimental journey to the venue to see that these posters were still there. And it's a shame. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary to see this, but a shame to see how poignant and tragic this particular poster has become since the time we did our Iraqi Pavilion in Venice. Thank you very much.
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Jonathan, for that moving presentation. Jonathan's kindly agreed to answer a few questions, if there are any. And I see Joan would like to ask a question.
I almost forgot. Thank you, it was incredible. But in the South, in the marshlands, when they were doing the weaving, how were they reviving that particular? Had they not lost any of those skills? Because up in their appeal, they've lost so many of their traditional skills.
It didn't seem so to me. And that's certainly not the message that I was getting.
And they passed it on.
Yeah. I mean, I was staying in reed huts and there were, you know, and the buffalo had come back and they were sort of making bread in the same way. I was with an amazing man who you probably know, Azam
Alawash.
Extraordinary man. And I have to say, he was, there are a number of extraordinary individuals in Iraq who are making such a huge difference, and he struck me as being one of them. I didn't go into this in so much depth. I know that in Kurdistan, as you say, in Erbil, there are these workshops that are being set up to reintroduce the skills of weaving, and particularly working with fabrics, carpet making, etc. And also felt making too, which I thought was smelly, but also really interesting.
Well, it's more than a question, it's more of a comment. I mean, there is a very interesting triangular relationship here, because you come here and talking about Venice Biennale, and you do it to us as BC. And of course, there is an historic relationship between Venice, Iraq, and British archaeology, which is Sir Henry Lyot, who actually had a palace on the Grand Canal, Palazzo Cappello, which is now University Ca' Foscari, and he lived there for a very long time, and that's where the university I studied, and that's how I started studying Iraq. Because
it's funny you should say that, because I was thinking, you know, while we were making this installation, it was almost as if we were making the place of somebody who was in Venice, but an Iraqi expert, you know, somebody who'd been there and collect, you know, it was almost like I was creating the home of somebody who was a resident but fascinated in Iraqi culture.
Unfortunately, his palace then was sold and became a university, so there is not the original kind of setting. But I thought it was wonderful that you came here with the Venice connection.
Well, if I'd known that, I would have written about it in the press release.
Are there any more questions?
Thank you, Jonathan. It was just fascinating to hear you talk about it again. Jonathan, I was wondering, the artists who went to Venice, what do you have an idea of what the effect on them was of coming to Venice and having this experience away from Iraq?
Yes, well, in fact, for some, it was changed everything, because some of them actually used Venice as a escape route. You know, two or three went and then didn't go back. One went to Helsinki, which, you know, there's another Iraqi artist there, and then came back to Italy, and that's where I lost track of him. Basim is in America still, I think. Then one of the Wami guys is now in Malaysia studying there. So so that was an effect for some of them. Others were, I mean, it's very hard to communicate how disconnected they are from the art world. We, you know, we're so au fait, so, you know, we know all about video in installation and performance, etc., etc., etc. But their education is such that that it tends to be very traditional fine art practice that that they or skills that they acquire. So I think that they when they came to Venice and saw what we were doing in the context of the Biennale, it all kind of made sense. That Hashim, for example, the other one from Wami, said, "Now I see what you know. Why you wanted us to do this? It seemed kind of mad, from our point of view. But now it all kind of clicks. And it's a first step. But what a wonderful. I mean, for these people, many of whom have never left Iraq, what an extraordinary, experience." But then you likely it sort of carries on, but fear that for many it may be a very isolated event. It's actually through the work of foundations such as Gulen and Ruya and others that you'd like to think that it was first step on a long journey of an adventure, an artistic adventure that was. It meant a lot to them.
Perhaps one more question or comment, if there is one.
Jonathan, what was the graffiti that was sprayed on front of the Marsh Arab land?
I think it's a phone number.
It's a grain dial. I think it's one.
Yeah, let's see if we. It's a phone number, isn't it?
Yeah.
It does not like, this is the heaven on earth to which we will return. It's Crane for Hire, and this is my favorite.
Well, on that note, I think we'll bring the evening to an end, and I thank all of them, and Adam, those of those who have us.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan is director of the Icon Gallery in Birmingham, and I'm director of Birmingham Museums Trust, which runs the city's museums, so we're very close colleagues. And the furthest my job has sent me has been Exeter. So I feel a little envy sometimes when I meet Jonathan and she's just back from Iraq or China or Sao Paulo or wherever. But tonight Jonathan has reminded me that I once lived in Iraq as well. He's reminded me of the incredible hospitality of the Iraqis, the beauty of the landscape, also of the terrible things that have happened in Iraq and are still happening, and more hearteningly of the fact that life goes on and that it almost goes without saying in a day when we've heard about the destruction of yet more cultural heritage. It's enormously inspiring to know that people are still able to create new art, but perhaps most of all, it's very heartening to know that people are still falling in love. So for all this, thank you very much, Jonathan.
Last but not least, it's my duty to thank the British Academy for allowing us to use these wonderful facilities. And for the support that they give to BC throughout the year, without which we would find it very difficult indeed to continue. I said last but not least because now a reception awaits you, so I'll officially call this AGM to close and invite you to the drinks which are happening in the next door room. Thank you all.